Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I am Renee Coleman, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and one-time future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man. What is going on?
Not too much. Had a week off there, but...
I'm missing game four of the World Series for this.
Oh, is that tonight?
Yes.
Huh. Okay. Now,
yeah,
now,
just letting you know that.
Well, I appreciate the sacrifice. Now, what's been going on with the World Series? The Dodgers are in it, right?
Oh, yeah. My Dodgers are in it, and they're ahead 2-1. And it's a no score right now in the bottom of the second, I think.
So is that best of seven?
Yeah, best of seven.
Okay,
yeah.
So they can't clinch it tonight.
No, they can't clinch it tonight.
Now, have you been watching all the games?
Oh, yeah. That's the only time baseball's exciting.
Well, I heard they had some exciting games, though, huh?
Oh,
particularly exciting, huh?
Oh, fuck yeah, man. It's the only time it's exciting is in October, and that's when you watch it. Because stuff happens.
Right. I haven't been able to catch any of them so far. I was traveling. I was flying back from Hawaii overnight. I was in Hawaii at a weird time of day. So,
Why were you in Hawaii?
I was over there playing, the Iguanas.
Oh, one of those senior citizens festivals?
Well, it was for people of many ages there, but it was all adults for the most part, although a few of the musicians had some kids there with them. Yes, it was the Big Island. No, it was the Maui Jazz and Blues Festival, and we're over there with Big Chief Donald Harrison and Chris Thomas King and all kind of jazz stars and Zydeco stars, Roddy Romero, Jordan Thibodeau.
Sounds like one of the worst gigs ever.
It was good for us. It's good.
Because you get paid.
It was a sold out show there in Maui at the Ritz-Carlton.
Now, let me ask you something, because I just saw this story just yesterday. Now, apparently Geritol's making a comeback.
Is it?
Yes, Geritol's making a comeback, so I figured your crowd is on Geritol, probably.
Well, there's a...
But the Geritol's making a comeback, apparently, because... Back when it was huge with the seniors, your crowd, it was for...
When you say my crowd, you're the same age as all these people.
I know, but your audience, though, they don't get up and stand. They're in their walkers and stuff, right?
Well,
they're walking around in their wheelchairs going, walk on, walk on.
Actually, in Hawaii, they had people getting up and dancing, and for whatever kind of licensing or whatever that they had at that venue... They had to come over and say, no, you can't dance here. You have to sit down. It's like,
because they don't want to get sued.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Because there's so many seniors
there
who are crippled and stuff like that. Maybe they were worried about them falling in the pig fire pit those Hawaiians do.
It was all indoors.
They cooked that poi.
The poi,
it's like a pig on parallel bars, like Mary Lou Retton,
Well, if Geritol's coming back, does that mean Lawrence Welk is coming back too?
Let's hope not.
Well, I was wondering, where are they going to advertise it? Maybe the baseball games.
It's coming back because apparently women are drinking it, not because of what it was first made for, but it's helping them get pregnant.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
there must be some fucking
minerals,
jizz in this Geritol.
Minerals and vitamins and minerals.
Some hot jizz.
Okay.
hot cum flowing down that Geritol throat.
I'm not sure that's the way it works, but...
Apparently this is a story I saw. My wife watched it actually just yesterday on the news.
Now, is your wife going to get in on the Geritol craze?
No.
No?
We're done having kids. She doesn't want to get pregnant.
Right. I mean, just to keep her going, keep the vitality up.
No, we have vodka for that.
Okay, sure.
Okay, we don't need Geritol.
Sure.
I don't know what you guys do.
Well,
they
have all kind of old-timey drugs like that they used to have on television, like Doane's pills. Remember those? Those were big
Doane's,
for your back pain. Doane's pills.
Yeah, Doane's, yeah.
BC powder.
BC powder, yeah. Well, I think those never really went out of style with a certain demographic,
The truckers, rednecks.
Rednecks, truckers,
Yeah.
I actually used to like BC because it gets into your system quick. You put it in water or something, or just right in your mouth, and try not to inhale it. The stuff could get some BC pneumonia. from that dust.
So it's back. Okay. I'm happy, know, for it's people, for women. You know, I'm willing
praise.
To get, if they want to get knocked up, I'm willing to give them my cum.
Really?
Yeah,
really? You
sure.
ready to be a surrogate father?
Yeah, I'll freeze it.
Okay.
They can put it in their freezer and shoot it up their pussy anytime
okay,
they want.
Okay, well.
You know?
It's keeping it classy.
Yeah.
Well, we have other news. We have Halloween right upon us.
Yeah.
You getting excited for Halloween?
Not really. I don't really care.
You get your costume all picked out?
No, I don't.
No,
do
okay.
That.
Get your razor blades all lined up for
no,
the apples?
I don't really do that. I like the kids, though. They come by, and I scream at them.
Mm-hmm.
I say, you guys are too scary for me. Get out of my porch. Get off my porch. You're too scary for me.
Yeah, they get a kick out of that.
Yeah, and I give them some candy and some toothpaste.
Right.
You know, I give them candy and toothpaste because they want the candy, but the parents want the toothpaste because after they eat the candy, they need to brush their teeth. So I give them toothpaste.
Something for everybody.
I got Arm & Hammer baking soda toothpaste.
Oh, that's popular with the kids.
Yeah, it's popular with the kids, you know, and the parents.
Sure.
You know, but yeah, so... anyway, what else is going on with you?
Well, I had a bad experience. I don't know if I mentioned it to somebody else, and they said that this has just happened to them recently. I'm boarding this flight. I'm on this flight. It's like a 7-hour flight from Maui to Denver. And about an hour and a half into the flight, it's a red eye overnight. I'm having my second cocktail. I have pretty much a full cocktail in my hand.
And you get the diarrhea?
No. Oh. And, let me get there. I kind of start falling asleep with the drink in my hand and wake up as I dump the whole thing into my lap.
Oh.
And totally soaked the seat of my pants. So...
So what you got the next 6 hours.
I had the next 6 hours of sitting there. Now, so I opened up the blanket and put it across the seat, you know, and kind of sat on it, hopefully to absorb some of it, at least. But man, miserable way to have to take a flight. Has that ever happened to you, Manny?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well,
no, I can control my alcohol.
Well, it's again, I was it wasn't the alcohol that was the problem. It was the falling asleep. But
you know, Denver Airport is supposed to be haunted. Too.
Denver's a freaky airport. It's got a lot of weird paintings on the walls, some post-apocalyptic kind of iconography, guys with masks on. Or it's I remember that. And then they used to talk about how it had all kind of tunnels underneath.
Right. And the Blue Horse, too.
The Blue Horse, yeah. I can't remember what the
I don't remember what it is. I just know it's the Blue Horse. Yeah.
But yeah, I was only in there for maybe 45 minutes. It was a tight...
Now,
tight.
When you landed in Denver, did you go to the men's room and use the air dryer to dry your balls and stuff that were wet?
What I did is mostly the outside had kind of dried off, but the underwear was still damp. Now... A few months
now,
ago...
Now, do you wear jockeys or boxers?
Boxers.
You wear boxers. Okay.
So, a few months ago...
Now, are they just one color, or are they kind of pattern boxers?
I have a variety of you know, you get them in the six-pack. They are all different. Some are plaid, some are solid colors. But I actually had a spare pair of boxer shorts in my carry-on bag, because I did it a few months ago, thinking, well, if my check bags don't arrive, at least I'll have socks and underwear. So I was able to go into the bathroom and put a dry pair of boxer shorts on.
Now, did you keep the soiled pair, or you threw them away?
Well, they weren't soiled. They were just wet with a...
Did you keep them?
I kept the pair that had been...
Why did you just toss them, man?
Well, because they weren't really that wet anymore. I mean, it was just kind of damp, you know? I just didn't want them against my
skin. But did they have Geritol cum stains on them?
No, it was a fresh pair of boxer shorts I'd just taken a shower.
So you put the soiled underwear in your
soiled.
Bag?
It was, again, it was a vodka soda, so it was... It wasn't even a Coca-Cola or anything like that. It just all had evaporated. Anyway...
Now, did your bandmates notice this and tease you?
I mentioned it to one of them after the flight, and he said, yes, same thing had happened to him.
On the
so
same flight?
No. Sometime in the past, except it was a Coca-Cola.
Hey, you guys are getting old, man.
Well, you know, you're flying overnight. You know, it's easy to fall asleep. Anyway, what's been going on with you, Manny?
Well, you know, they had that... No Kings thing here in the city and all over the country, all over the world.
Sure, you must have attended, huh?
Well, I was trying to attend it, But, you know, my wife and the group of yammering bitches were getting together to all, you know, be a part of it.
Okay.
And I said, I'll meet you there.
Uh-huh.
I'll meet you there.
Sure.
And, of course, you know, I always get, you know, my time and my locations and things confused because I am a troubled man. But I ended up...
Alzheimer's.
I ended up on Bourbon Street holding a sign saying, no queens.
Okay.
That's, I got my ass kicked.
That's a different. Yeah, that's a different group.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was totally. You know, so you know, I just made the mistake. I got the wrong location.
Right, right.
So that happened while in the past couple of weeks, you know. But I was there, you know, the no queens thing, and so it wasn't a good thing.
Yeah.
But then I also, our good friend, Wadzilla.
Wadzilla.
Yeah, who's living in Seattle, you know, waiting for a bus.
Uh-huh.
You know, he hooked me up this year with for the football season with this this program where I get all the games for free.
Oh,
and I get
okay.
all the I got like 4,000 channels. I got every movie channel.
Wow.
I got so much shit. But I was thumbing through it because he said, you know, to get used to it because you got to You know, there's over 4,000 channels, and I can watch anything. I can watch fucking soap operas on the West Coast. That you know, I can watch anything I want. It's amazing.
Film from Diddy parties.
Yeah, that or, stuff.
Epstein. Epstein files.
Epstein files. Yeah, the greatest pimp ever.
Right.
Epstein. I was going through the this list of movie channels. There was about 2,000 movie channels, and I did not know this. You see these movies that are casted and stuff, and I was watching this documentary about Tom Hanks, and I did not know that, you know, before you know he did that movie, You Got Mail.
Mm-hmm.
The original person they wanted for that movie was Ted Kaczynski. You Got Mail.
Okay.
And Meg Ryan. Ted Kaczynski, Meg Ryan.
It's an odd pairing.
It probably would have been a bomb at the box office.
Oh, there you go. Okay. There you go.
I like it.
Ba-dum bunks. Yeah. So it's funny how there's so much crap out there. And so that was good. It was a good documentary. And they interviewed Kaczynski. You know, and he had really nothing to say. You know, except his manifesto.
He
said, "Read the manifesto," but he did audition, and there's a screen test of
him. Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, with him and Meg Ryan doing an audition together.
Yeah,
and she was so great back then. You know, I don't know what she's like now. I haven't seen her in years, but she was really great back then. You know,
she looks like she's. She's had work.
She's older.
She's had work done.
Well, you know, as actresses are trying to stay relevant.
Some stay, you know, just act their age, and others get the plastic surgery.
You know, the documentary shows that she really wanted Ted for the part.
Huh? Well, they had.
She was tired of Tom Hanks, Sleepless in Seattle, and all that bullshit. You know, she wanted Ted. She fell for Ted.
Oh, huh.
She understood Ted.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You ever see that movie, Ted?
Ted?
About that
teddy
bear?
No, I never watched it.
That's a hilarious movie. Yeah. You got to see that movie.
Okay, they made a second one.
Ted 2.
Yeah. Follow up.
It's
so many unanswered questions from the first one.
You see this little bear, like a stuffed teddy bear, fucking a chick. That's the most fucking funny thing you ever want to see, man.
That's
a kid's movie.
Yeah.
Something for the kids.
Yeah.
For the grandkids.
Have you seen those movies?
I saw a little bit of the first one. It was cute.
Yeah.
What I saw. I couldn't hold
my attention. I'm kind of allergic to Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, I could see that.
A little
that.
Bit, yeah.
I could see that.
And Seth, what's his name? I've never found him funny. But that's just me.
Is that Seth Rogen?
No, the Family Guy.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's the voice of the of
right,
the teddy
right.
Ted,
teddy
yeah, yeah, he's yeah, the voice yeah, of Ted. Yeah. I liked him.
Oh, very good. What else? Well, there's a big NBA cheating scandal that just broke the other day, man.
Yeah.
Have you been following that?
Not really.
Oh, okay. Because
I always know it's fixed anyway.
You always talk about how
it's fixed,
so
it
doesn't surprise
it's
you in any way.
It's all Vegas, man. Since fucking day one, it's been Vegas, man.
Yeah, well,
you know. And these poor guys, you know, these NBA players, and there's probably, you know, it's ever since they made it all legal... you're going to get this.
Sure.
You know, it's going to be,
what do you expect is going to happen?
Yeah. It's like, whatever, man. It's all Vegas.
Okay.
So basically, anytime my teams lose, I'll just go, it's Vegas.
Yeah.
It's all Vegas.
But the one guy, it's a poker thing, and it's the five families of New York.
Yeah.
It's a real mafia stuff.
Sure.
It?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's poker.
Old Vegas. Mafia.
Yeah, well, that's
old
true
Vegas.
Too. Yeah.
That's
right.
True.
Right. It's also, yeah. also.
Bugsy Siegel.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Obviously. Well, anything else, or should we get to
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Over the weekend, I saw this in Biloxi, Mississippi, of all places. Some people were having a private pool party at a hotel in Biloxi, Mississippi. And some guy who looked, I saw the picture, he looked like a cross between one of those Duck Dynasty guys and a Geritol guy, I guess. I don't know. But he crashed the party claiming that he was a member of the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
He was a member of the Rolling Stones who got fired.
Huh.
And he had a guitar with him. And his name was Raymond Lurk or something like that. So he crashed this party claiming to be a member of the Stones. He had a guitar. He said Mick Jagger had fired him.
Okay.
And as they called the cops on him, and he kept screaming that Keith Richards owes him for gas money. And he also said...
Got off easy.
He said... He would sign autographs if they wanted to.
Oh, okay. That's very generous.
And he kept screaming, "You can't drown rock and roll." And they had him arrested and stuff. Huh. And apparently he played the guitar for him. He says, "These are my riffs." And he was playing like Satisfaction and Honky Tonk Woman to them and stuff like that. But the cops had enough of him.
Yeah, he's insane.
But he had said that Mick had fired him and all that stuff.
Right,
so I thought that was entertaining,
okay.
You know.
Now, you said this was at a Waffle House? No, it was a pool party.
A pool party. At...
In Biloxi.
In Biloxi that some family had, rented the pool or whatever.
Right, right. Shit goes down in Biloxi, man. It used to be a hotbed of the Gulf Coast Mafia there in Biloxi.
That's true, yeah.
Lots of... Lots of goings on there. I think there's a judge got assassinated back in the 80s. It's a whole big stink. Yeah.
Oh.
So I remember I was going to before they had the casinos there. They just had putt-putt golf, a few video arcades, and maybe Slippery Sam's. You know, a little water park.
Right, right.
And,
no, my
Krispy Kreme donuts.
My grandparents have a house. Well, they're not with us anymore, but the house is still on Bay St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Well,
so I spent a lot of my young summers going.
Right.
Going into Gulfport and Biloxi, but mostly on the
right.
Bay. But
so
yeah,
you know they had a seedy side too.
Very seedy side.
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The shops that have the shells, the shells all piled up that you could buy a conch shell.
Right. Oh yeah. 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 So fronts some money laundering
probably
operation. Well. How about now, man? Should we get a guest in here?
Yeah.
All right,
great.
We have a terrific guest I've known for a while. He's a man of wears many hats. He's an author with his fourth novel coming out on November 15th. He's a publisher of the Dirty Magic magazine, which is ramping back up into production after a bit of a hiatus. He's a video producer. He's worked as a video producer for Tipitinas and many other things. Also does production for the current YouTube show Escape from the Secret Lab. And he's also a college professor here in town, teaches at several of the universities. We're going to get into all that and much more. But without further ado, the great Mr. Charlie Brown.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
I've been
looking forward to sitting down with y'all and see where this goes.
All right, yeah.
Well, Charlie.
Yes.
You ever want to fucking cut that bitch Lucy for pulling the football away?
Ugh. That, you know.
Never heard that before.
I had plotted in my mind a live action Charlie Brown thing where Charlie Brown goes and shoots Lucy and drags her to a football field and puts the finger on, and then the last shot is him kicking the football. But I never shot it.
Oh, okay. Well, let's do it, man. Let's do it.
It was a little dark.
Ah, well, you know.
It couldn't play the New Orleans Film Festival because they don't.
Maybe Zeitgeist.
Yeah, maybe Zeitgeist. It could definitely play Zeitgeist.
Charlie, I know you're not from New Orleans.
No, I am from New Orleans.
You are from New Orleans.
Yeah, I'm born and raised. Yeah.
I had no idea. You had me fooled.
Great homework, Renee.
Sometimes you like to surprise people.
My mother's family goes back to 1804 on one side and 1839 on the other side.
Okay.
So we're deep, deep.
Oh, right on.
My last name is Brown. My dad is from Atlanta, but I'm part of the Derbys family, the real estate people, so you still see our signs around town.
Oh, right on. What neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in Old Metairie, right off of Old Metairie Road. Of that, I will never drive on a main street. I will always take the side streets.
Okay.
I'm a true Metairie driver.
Right.
But I've been living up, you know, I've lived in just about every neighborhood of New Orleans. Except Lakeview. I've lived in Bywater. I've lived in Mid-City, Uptown.
Gert-town.
Never got to Gert-town, unfortunately.
I love saying Gert-town.
Yeah. It's good. Something it feels weird. Good. Yeah.
Yeah, feels good to say that.
Well, so where'd
missed
you
out on Pigeon-town.
Pigeon-town, yeah. So where'd you go to high school?
I am a Jesuit boy.
Jesuit, okay.
So I'm...
So did you knock up your high school sweetheart?
I didn't have a high school sweetheart. I was...
you were running from the priest?
Too many priests running for you? No, the priests weren't going after me, but it's an all-boys school, so it was really difficult. And I was kind of a shy kid, so... I actually went to my first school was Sam Barth. I don't know if you remember Sam Barth.
I know the name.
Yeah, it was out. It's out there in Metairie. It's now Ecole Classique.
Oh,
that
sure.
That was an all boys school. And then for 2 years, I went to St. Catherine's, and then I went to Jesuit. So most of my life, I was at all boys schools, and so it took me a long time to get some game together. So,
now, so a lot of masturbation.
Oh yeah,
you regret not having gone to co-ed schools.
Since I was in Metairie, I couldn't have gone to Ben Franklin, which is the one place I would have liked to have gone. It worked out.
There were a few people living in Metairie going to Ben Franklin, but you had to be a little bit proactive with the paperwork.
We didn't know anybody that lived in Orleans Parish.
Really?
To be honest.
Okay.
My grandfather had a big hand in developing Old Metairie when they first moved there in 1955. My mom talks about there was a goat farm and there was all this sort of stuff. There was nothing there. And then, you know, and so my grandfather developed a lot of that land.
Okay.
Well, so all that stuff around Old Metairie Road is, you know, partially, you know, us developing.
Oh, nice. Must have made a pretty penny.
He was a very rich man, and I am not.
Okay. Well, sometimes they don't maintain the fortune as over the years.
It may come to me eventually. My mom is still alive and kicking, doing great. She's in her 80s. She looks like she's 70. She's doing really well.
Having money doesn't hurt. Keeps
her
young.
Keeps her young. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Well, okay. Well, that's surprising because I know you went to school other places. So,
yeah.
Well, when you were a shy kid, were you a bookish kid? Were you reading a ton?
Very bookish. Very bookish. Read a lot of sci-fi.
Lord of the Rings. And then,
no, I didn't get into Lord of the Rings. I read The Hobbit, and then I was really mad when I picked up Lord of the Rings, and Bilbo was the bad guy all of a sudden. So I didn't read Lord of the Rings until I got to college.
Okay.
But I was actually obsessed with this science fiction writer by the name of Philip Jose Farmer, who was a Los Angeles writer, and he was part of the sci-fi new wave, and he wrote this really weird stuff. His most famous work is Riverworld, which was a 5-book series where everybody who ever lived is reincarnated on this giant river, and all of their needs are taken care of, and it was a giant experiment by aliens. So it's a strange little book.
Yeah. Now, were you attracted to Mormonism because of this?
No,
because they have a similar kind of theme going, or what's the other one? Scientology.
No, I never got into Scientology. I used to, when I lived in Los Angeles, I lived in Los Feliz, and I saw the Scientology. I was right near the Scientology. We would drive to the movies.
Yeah, the Church of Scientology.
Church of Scientology, right on
East
Sunset.
Hollywood.
Yeah, right on Sunset.
Yeah, me and my friend tried to blow it up in high school. We drove down to Tijuana in our senior year in high school because we had this English teacher who was trying to teach us Scientology on the side.
Oof.
In a public school.
Yeah.
So we said, fuck this guy. So we drove down to Tijuana. We got a bunch of quarter sticks of dynamite.
Oh, my God.
And we easily crossed the border back then. It's like 1980, 81. And we went to the Church of Scientology, and we had taped all these quarter sticks of dynamite, and we had thrown them in this mailbox in front of the church, and we lit the wick, and we got the fuck out of there. But the wick... Never.
It blew out.
Fortunately.
Yeah. Fortunately.
Avoided committing a federal crime.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we used to drive.
They would have never caught us. There was no hopefully, camera.
We used to drive to the movies and like go by, you know, take Fountain to. And we would see at 5 o'clock what we called the March of the Scientologists.
Right.
With all those people in the polyester vests going from. You know, they're slaves, basically, and you're walking from the office to the cafeteria or whatever.
Right.
It was very strange.
We would scream at them and curse their bikes. You know, your bike's going to flat. You're going to get a flat on your bike.
So you're never tempted to go get audited or grab the e-meters.
No, besides
table
being,
work.
Besides being shy, I am not a joiner.
Okay.
I am not
you're
a joiner.
Not a
joiner.
Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah, I never...
Why do you want to join anything?
Yeah, I never joined a fraternity. I didn't want to be in a fraternity. Yeah. I'm kind of like Groucho Marx, you know?
Sure.
Any club that wants me, I don't want to join.
Sure, yeah.
Right,
you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Were
you writing early on?
I wasn't, no. My original kind of creative outlet was DJing. So at Jesuit... They had a DJ setup that broadcast to the cafeteria.
Uh-huh.
And so students were allowed to spin records.
Really? That's kind of surprising.
It was a cool, it was actually a really cool setup. And around this time I'd really gotten into the blues. I got into the blues when I was about 15, 16.
What year did you graduate?
86.
Oh, okay.
So people who you might know who were 86 Jesuit was Jim McCormick was in that class.
Right. My brother.
Oh, well. Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So and also Lewis Daubin, who runs Escape from the Secret Lab with me, and then we were one year behind Harry Connick.
Do DJ.
I did DJ work, and so I would play these soul and R&B records, and all the teachers would be jamming downstairs, and all the students were like, "What is this crap that they're playing?" And because of that, I got the nerve up to go and do training at WWOZ because they were a little more open. This was the, like I said, 86. And I did training with them, and this is the truth. You may not believe me, but this is the truth. The very first Thursday night that wasn't Ernie Cato was me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I did the show, and then I only did about two or three other shows for them because I didn't get a permanent spot mm-hmm. because I was, but I would go do that, and then Friday nights, do all the things that a hip kid would do.
That's when you were still in high school.
I was still in high school, okay. Yeah. And then I would go I would go over Friday nights and hang out with Duke Paducah and BB, mm-hmm. and they mentored me,
nice.
And they really got into that old music. I don't know why that music spoke to me, but it did. You know, Muddy Waters in particular, but
right.
Professor Longhair, all the New Orleans stuff. Yeah, I'd listen to. I called it Mardi Gras music back then, uh-huh. but we know it as great New Orleans R&B.
Right.
But yeah, it was just like music was the first thing that drew me in.
Okay. Well, so at what point do you start writing?
So I go to college at USC, and then I didn't.
Now you went to undergrad.
I went to
USC?
Undergrad at USC, but
how
it didn't.
How did that happen?
I got over a 3.0.
Okay.
USC was real easy to get into. And I thought I was good.
Y'all had all that real estate money. So
yeah, we did, actually. Yeah.
So you graduate high school here and you go to USC and SoCal.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to go to L.A., I think, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't want to go to the film school. I thought I wanted to be in production. I thought maybe journalism, but none of it really, USC just didn't take. And so so I came back here, and I went to Loyola, and I enrolled in the production, in the communication school there. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, my old friend from Jesuit, Mark Meester, who you might know, he's a...
Oh, yeah, I know Mark Meester well.
Yeah, yeah. Mark called me up and said, okay, WTUL is losing its blues disc jockey. Do you want to take over? So I was, yes. So I took over that, started doing the blues show. While doing that show, I got a call at WTUL, and it was Connie Atkinson from Wavelength Magazine.
Oh, sure. You know, Connie. Too.
And she goes, do you want to write for Wavelength Magazine? I was one of those kids who had really bad grammar. So I was like, I can't write. I'm a terrible writer. But I had just started taking journalism classes because I had to. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was like, okay, I'll meet with you. And then so I started writing for Wavelength, and I wrote for Wavelength for about a year and a half.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that was how you got your feet wet.
Yeah.
So when you were at USC, this is in the mid 80s or something. Now, were you a Crip or a Blood? Because USC is in one of the, back in the 80s, that neighborhood was fucking hairy.
The 32nd Street Market was one of my favorite places. And later on, when I was at Loyola, one of my professors, who was a Nigerian woman, she and I bonded over our love of the 32nd Street Market.
The Hoover Crips, man.
Yeah.
Those guys will get you.
Yeah, I didn't have a car, so I was pretty much stuck at...
But you lived on campus.
Yeah, I lived on campus.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. USC was... I enjoyed it. It just, like I said, it just didn't take. It didn't have what I needed then, and then later on... I decided to go to grad. When I went to decide to go, I needed to go to grad school, USC was there for me.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah. So you went back.
I went back, and I actually got a degree that.
But you got a degree from Loyola first.
Yeah, I got a degree in journalism from Loyola, and then I got out of school. While I was there, I'd taken some writing classes from John Biganay, and screenwriting classes from Andy Horton. So I was starting to move from journalism into fiction, so I never took a journalism job.
Okay.
And I just kind of fooled around, and then I finally found a woman who wanted to date me.
Okay.
And be with me, and we ended up getting married.
Now what do you think won her over? Was it your mastery of prose, or was it your DJing, or just
your cock?
Yeah.
Your large cock.
It wasn't that. I can tell you that.
No, it's not that.
No, a sparkling personality, maybe?
Okay, there you go.
Maybe my gift of gab, I think that was part of it, you know. Yeah. I've always been as good of a talker as I am a writer, so.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're hanging out here, and you know, I went to work for Jesuit briefly, trying to write a history for them, but this
is right out of college.
Yeah, right out of college, didn't quite take. I ended up writing, and I was like, okay, now I'm going to be. Let me do a job that'll give me the summers off. I'll go teach. So I went to UNO, got my high school teaching diploma, and it was that bad.
Did you go to actually teach in high school?
Oh, it was so bad.
Where did you teach?
My first school was Barbre in Kenner, which you had to pause
so
every
how
now.
How many years have you gone to school? I mean, you got
a lot.
Yeah, it seems like you what, 5, 8, 10 years of college?
No, I've only got a master's degree. I didn't get a doctorate, so about 7 years of college.
Yeah. Jesus.
And then I taught at Barbre. And I didn't like that at all. That was in Kenner. And then I taught at the old Kennedy.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that was awful.
On
the Boss Street. Yeah, right. Yeah, right on the bayou.
Yeah.
That was way too rough.
It's so also a toxic dump site.
Yes, it is.
Turns out.
Yeah. And then I said, okay, no more public school. I got hired at De La Salle, and that didn't take.
That was even worse.
Yeah. I realized. If you're trapped like a high school or something like that, and you have to be there, I'm a terrible teacher. But if in college, you don't really have to be there, I'm fine. Because I work a little blue. You know, I work a little blue.
Okay.
You know, and De La Salle, they didn't want to hear that.
Yeah.
So, But De La Salle was, yeah, so the De La Salle was a very good school. I mean, like, so the woman that I married and I were not getting along. I was very depressed. I was very overweight. I even went on antidepressants and it just made me feel ill, and right. it never really made me feel good. Mm. And so I just walked away from that life, and we had a falling out, almost got divorced, stuck it up for another 2 years, and then it didn't work. So I said, I need to do what I've always wanted to do, move back to Los Angeles and try my hand at screenwriting. So in 97, Henry Griffin, who you know,
right,
had been out there for a year and had sold a script. So I followed in his wake and moved out to LA in 97.
And you knew him how?
He went to Jesuit.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, he's 1 year behind me at Jesuit. Okay, and he also went to Loyola. We worked on The Maroon together.
Okay.
So Henry and I got real close in the early late 80s, early 90s.
Now Henry was already out there doing screenwriting.
Yes. He had already sold his first script, and so I was like, oh, I can sell my first script. Yeah.
He also worked on that show that ripped me off, Tremé.
Oh, did he work on that?
He did work on Tremé. Oh, okay. He never wrote for Tremé. He acted in it.
Right. He appeared.
Yeah, he ripped me off that show.
It wasn't him, though.
No, it wasn't him.
Yeah.
That writer who used to write for the Times,
Louis Eli.
He wrote the episode where he ripped off my line.
Did he? I graduated from high school with Eric.
See, I'm the trouble man for troubled times, and all of a sudden on this episode, I'm watching it, and the Steve, what's his name, says, "I'm a desperate man for desperate times." He totally just ripped me off.
Yes, he did. Tremé is one of my few television movie paychecks, because I'm a member of the Valparaiso Men's Chorus, and I appeared in the Valparaiso show, and
a check for 80 cents?
No, I got $300. It was a pretty good paycheck. It was a pretty good paycheck.
People are still watching that show?
No,
this was in
the original appearance.
2011. This was 2011.
Yeah. Right. Are you still getting a check for $300? No.
I got one
check.
Yeah, I didn't get
any. You bought crack with that check, didn't you? You and your wife went on a crack binge.
Who knows?
You know, I don't think I've ever actually seen crack. I've seen a few things, but I've never actually seen crack.
Okay.
Well, what kind of crack are you
talking about?
What kind of crack are you talking about?
Well, you know, ass crack. I've seen a lot of that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, baby.
Tijuana.
Yeah. Well, USC times, man. The Hoover Crips, yeah. Baby.
So you move out there to L.A. to pursue a master's degree? Is that?
No, I moved to L.A. first just to be a screenwriter.
Now, is Nikki Catt hanging around at this point?
So, yeah, me and Nikki Catt get to be really good friends. And so day two, so first thing, I'm going to drop another name, I'm going to pull into Adam Duritz's driveway, because that's where Henry was living.
Okay. Singer from Counting Crows.
Singer from Counting Crows. Henry comes out and says, "All right, clean up, we're going to the Hollywood Bowl." So this is the first, I literally had just pulled into LA, go to the Hollywood Bowl, and we watch Dave Brubeck.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was great. Next night, we go to a party at the Chateau Marmont, which is a very swanky hotel. And it's a party for John Sloss, this Hollywood lawyer who represents all of the Dazed and Confused people. So this is day two, and I am meeting almost all of the cast of Dazed and Confused, except McConaughey. McConaughey wasn't there, but Nikki was among them, but Rory Cocker. And I had my first hit of Los Angeles weed. So by the end of that party...
No crack. Shocking.
Yeah, but I'm literally smoking with the Dazed and Confused.
Why did a cast of Dazed and Confused need a lawyer? I mean, they're all just like... amateur actors.
No, they were... By then, they were professional.
Parker Posey.
This was like 3 or 4 years after Dazed and Confused
came out. So yeah. They're suing to get their pay.
Right.
I got you.
So my head is like... So by the end of that, my head is like a balloon on a string. You know, I'm just really high. But Nikki and I get to talking, and we start making friends. And then Sloss takes me and Henry across the street to the Mondrian for dinner, which is this one of the swankiest restaurants in Los Angeles, and everything is white. Everything is white. Everybody's in white. I'm high as a kite.
Except and all for the dishwasher.
Right. And well, that's true. I could just see floating heads everywhere. And it was like, I felt like I was in a Kubrick movie or something.
Okay.
You know? But that was, yeah, that was night two. And then after that, I was
it was
just
all downhill.
Yeah, it was all downhill. But it was ups and downs. But
sure.
But I decided pretty early on that I was going to be a bum, because cool. I've been living a pretty hardcore middle class existence. Like, no, I'm just going to write and just take the occasional. I'm going to be a flaneur, as they would say in Paris.
I don't know that
slumming
word.
It in L.A.
Slumming it in L.A. It was tough. Well, in 97 you could.
Yeah, of course you could.
Yeah, because my first apartment in Los Feliz, back when it was just a Armenian neighborhood.
Yeah.
It was $6.25 a month, so you know,
yeah.
I had some savings, and so I just like worked, did temp jobs, and just kind of kept up and kept writing, you know, trying to build up a bank of screenplays so that I could sell one. And then,
well, let me stop you right there, because it's an exciting part of the story here. And it's also that time in the show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Manny's going to
take a break. Listen, Charlie Brown, the nation knows what to do. We'll be right back.
We're back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Coleman, back with our guest, Mr. Charlie Brown. Now, Charlie, I know you are one of our devoted listeners. You're familiar with the operational model of this podcast, where we are listener-supported. We have the Venmo and PayPal links in the show notes of every show, as well as the Facebook page, and our listeners will use those links to support the show, buy us rounds of cocktails, and help us defray our costs. And we always like to announce people that have supported the show that week. Well, we have no announcements this week. But that's okay. We're still running.
I blame myself.
Sure. Well, I blame you as well.
Yeah. Because nobody likes me.
Well, I like you, but
some people.
Some people. It's a smaller and smaller.
I like burnt toast too.
You like burnt toast? Sure. Yeah.
I like jock itch.
Okay. Well, that's, I guess to each his own.
I like loose change. Too.
We like loose change. Yes.
Yeah, we like
and,
it all.
So if anybody has loose change out there, please, you can send it in to us. Also, we have the Patreon page. We have a handful of patrons that are supporting us week in and week out. We love you. Also, the Troubled Men t-shirt link is right there, and Christmas is getting closer all the time, so I wouldn't waste any time there. Also, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps us a lot. Costs you nothing. You know, I had a friend, old friend, who's become a devoted listener, and he said that he's taken to using that phrase when he turns in a report at work or something. He'll say to his coworkers who turned into, give me a 5-star rating. Helps me a lot. Costs you nothing. I was like, oh, I like that. We're becoming part of the
lexicon.
Lexicon. That's the word. Thank you. You are a writer.
Yes.
All right, well, enough of all that. You know, back to you. Mr. Charlie Brown. When we last left you, you were there in L.A., banking a lot of screenplays, hanging out with the great Nikki Catt.
Yes.
Now, I first became aware of Nikki Catt in the movie Boiler Room.
Okay, so I have a lot of Boiler Room stories.
I love that movie. I think it's a great movie, man, especially like a high concept, like low production cost. I would imagine you just need like a warehouse and just keep changing the sets up. And,
right.
You know, Giovanni Ribisi is great in it. Nikki Catt is great as an asshole.
Yeah, Nikki specialized in the asshole roles. He was very good.
Is that the movie with Ben Affleck?
Affleck is in it briefly, yes.
Oh, okay, yeah. Because so, I think they sold that movie on him being in it.
Oh.
Yeah, because, you know, he was
He has the same amount of time that Alec Baldwin has in Glengarry Glen Ross. Yeah.
But he's not as good as it.
Well, yeah. He's not as good as Alec Baldwin was now.
Put the coffee down.
Yeah. So, so Nikki gets that movie.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, I am his screenwriter. We are working on a project that a doomed project that was this thing was so over the top. It was an adaptation of the 1890s book Pan, which is this very dark Norwegian story about a hunter who gets in a very toxic relationship with a woman, and they end up fighting each other, and there's a dog involved and all that. Anyway, so Nikki's went to me and said, "All right, we're gonna do this.
You're gonna adapt.
Yeah, we're gonna adapt this, but it's going to be black biker gangs in Oakland.
Okay, still a basic story.
Still a basic story. So we anyway.
Because there's dogs.
Because there's a dog. Anyway, so we had taken trips to Oakland. We had done all this research, and finally I'm writing, because he kept me from writing for a little time. So he finally like took me off the leash, so to speak.
Okay,
and he moves me to New York while he's doing Boiler Room, and so I'm living here. Dead broke. I mean, I've got maybe $200 in my bank account at this point in time, and I'm living at the Soho Grand for 3 weeks while he's doing Boiler Room. So I meet Vin Diesel. Vin Diesel gives me a nickname. Vin Diesel, like, we're having dinner with Vin Diesel, and he turns to me and says, "Oh, I'm looking for a screenwriter. What do you write?" He's like, "Oh, I do a lot of crime stuff. I do some mafia stuff." And he goes, "Who the hell are you? Are we going to see, you know, Nikki Catt is dead in his bed with a pencil in his neck, and it's going to be Charlie Manslaughter Brown who'd take his..."
God.
Yeah, so the only person who still calls me Manslaughter is Henry and Alex McMurray.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because Nikki...
Vin Diesel does.
Yeah, now, I haven't seen Vin Diesel in years.
His career's dead.
Yeah, I met Giovanni, I met all these guys, and I finally finished that script.
Okay.
I finally finished that script, and I meet on that time, I meet Jamie Kennedy and Scott Kahn, who are also in that.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, "Okay, we have a project. We're not writers, but we need a screenwriter. We know how to do scenes, but we don't, you know." And this is true of actors. Actors can write really good scenes, but they have a really hard time with arcs.
Okay.
So like the long term, so like the plots are hard. So we hooked up and we rewrote for Bob Simons Productions, who was Adam Sandler's first producer. He did all the early Sandler stuff. It was a snowboarding movie. And I like to say that we took it from Porky's 3 level about to the Porky's level. So we rewrote it.
Okay.
And that was another...
Never seen any of those movies. Have you seen those Porky's movies?
Yeah, I saw at least the first one, I think. It was early 80s. Yeah,
it was raunchy. And that's basically what this was.
Yeah,
the raunchy, you know, slobs versus snobs.
I just don't remember why they called it Porky's.
Yeah, that was the name of the strip club.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. That's
so...
Right.
So that all happens, and I'm like, I'm flying high.
That's the strip club I want to go to.
Right, it really
sounds like fat chicks, man.
Yeah. I'm flying high. I go to South by Southwest to meet up with Nikki and Henry for, you know, to hang out. And then, so I was like, I got the script going with Nikki, and I got this thing going. And I come back after a week. My script, the Jamie Kennedy, Scott Kahn script has gone into turnaround. means that it's dead.
Okay.
And Nikki can't get anything going with our script. And then and Bob Simons didn't pay me a dime, even though I'd worked for 3 weeks on this.
What thing. About Vin Diesel? Didn't
Vin you? Wasn't around either. I couldn't find Vin. So
he took his nickname back.
Right, I should have. Yeah. So I looked at my bank account and I was like, that's 18 grand in debt.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was like, oh shit.
I should go to school.
Yeah, no. So I called my mom and I was like that, and she goes, all right, you're moving home. And I was like, okay, I'm going to move home. And then that's when Adam stepped in. Adam Duritz, he said, no, you're not moving home. You're moving in with me. Oh. And I move into the Beverly Hills mansion. So now I'm dead broke, 18 grand in debt, working at a coffee shop in Los Feliz, but I'm living in Beverly Hills.
Oh, okay.
And so,
well, that must have been pretty wild, the traffic in and out.
It was so much fun.
Are you hanging out at the Viper Room a lot? Because I know Adam was always there.
This was just after the Viper. I didn't really hang out at the Viper. We didn't do the Viper Room very much.
He was kind of done. Man, I have a hard time believing that.
Yeah, he didn't. By that time, Adam had stopped kind of going to the Viper Room.
Yeah, because he was there a lot when I was working there.
Right, they were working on their third record.
Yeah,
he was kind of like,
just leave.
Yeah.
You're here too much. You're a good guy, but just don't hang out here that much.
Right. So through Adam, after about trying to hook stuff up, I finally get a job with a website called MediaTrip.com, which is one of the first multimedia websites, and I end up doing a whole lot of different stuff. I'm a entertainment reporter. I'm a music critic. I'm a movie critic.
And what year is this?
This is 99.
Okay, so now internet's
big. Yeah, now the internet is starting. This is the first big wave.
Before it all goes to hell, right?
Right. So I'm starting to work with digital video. I'm starting to do this. I'm starting to get all this stuff. And then our CEO, it turns out our CEO is using VC money to pay for his gym and for his own SUV. We lose all the money. Website goes under. And I'm back to square one. So I had written a short script, and I never made a short film. So I shot this short film out in Palm Springs. It's called A Couple on the Side. It's on
it's on YouTube. Some of that today.
Yeah, it's a movie about swingers. It's a it's a depressing comedy about swingers.
Sure.
And with the great Lex Medlin, who
you think it's going to end well.
Right. With the great Lex Medlin and one of my best friends, Heidi Van Horn. And so I shoot it, move back to New Orleans, cut it here. Tim Watson cuts it here, and Kristen Stoffa too. We put that together. It gets into the New Orleans Film Festival along with another movie I produced down here called Graveyard Diary that had Rio Hackford and Chris Lane in it.
Oh, yeah.
It was directed by my old roommate, Jonathan Taylor. So I was like, okay, from all that, I get to NOLA.com. Here's the funny story.
Okay.
I met my wife driving home from Los Angeles. She lived in Houston. I met her. She was a contributor to our boards because she was a Counting Crows fan. I met her. We had we met up for dinner. We just clicked. And so I'm in a relationship with her. She visits in New Orleans for the first time, and I say, "All right, we're gonna walk down Bourbon Street once, and then we're never coming back again." So right after that, I get the job at NOLA.com, where I become the host of BurboCam.
Oh, okay.
Outside of Cat's Meow, stopping people on the street. Hey, how you doing? As I like to say, it's improv journalism, stopping people from having fun for the streaming camera. So
interesting.
I do.
Interesting. That's when. So NOLA.com didn't have any idea what this was supposed to be. They just throwing stuff at the wall.
It was a very popular show, though. Yeah, a lot of people did tune in to watch it.
Now, you'd already gotten your master's from.
No, I haven't got my master's yet. Right. I haven't got my master's yet. So I just start doing a lot of NOLA.com was really my film school.
Okay.
So that's where I really learned. So I'm shooting and editing and writing all of my own stuff.
So it's just you and like one other producer, Corey,
and a couple of other people. Uh-huh. And then Adam Shipley comes to me and says, Cerebirth's 20th anniversary. We need to do something. Do you want to direct a documentary about that? And so he said, okay. I said, yes. Come work for the Tipitina's Foundation. We're going to start the foundation. So I go work for them, and I do video. You mentioned Donald Harrison. Donald Harrison was working as the
artistic director.
Yeah.
So the guy that wound up having a gun accident, right? What was his name?
Roland.
Roland, yeah.
Bastard. Sorry to speak ill about the dead, but that man, ugh. But also there was Trombone Shorty at 19.
Uh-huh.
And he was helping out. And so I did, I filmed the guest stars that came through there, John Scofield, Gate Mouth Brown, Chris Thomas King, a couple of other people that I'm forgetting right now. George Porter was in there. And then shooting the rebirth movie and shooting the internship program. The internship program and I were not a great fit.
Okay.
So I moved on after 1 year, and I just finished the rebirth. And that was my first feature film. Was Never a Dull Moment. 20 years of the Rebirth Press.
Yeah, which was kind of a landmark production in many ways.
I like to think so. Some other local people didn't, but I won't mention any names.
Yeah, but your friend Davis, I remember. I heard this story through Carlo Nuccio. Davis was at Bonnaroo with Rebirth. And he was fucked up, and he took a piss in one of the trombone players' case, and they beat the shit out of him.
I think I've heard that story, too. But
yeah. That didn't make it into the movie.
Yeah.
Damn.
But I did get a lot
of
stuff.
They're still around, that band?
Yeah. Phil Frazier, the tuba player, had to retire because he had a stroke.
Okay.
And I think the only one from the movie left is Stafford Agee, the trombone player.
Oh, so they're not the original lineup.
Yeah, they've gone through a lot of guys.
Okay.
But I did get a great story about from between Phil Frazier and the drummer Mallory, AJ Mallory, and the late Keith Keller.
Keith Keller, one of my close friends.
Who talked about getting into a fist fight during a Rebirth because the drums and tuba were doing great tracks, but the trumpets weren't. And so Keith made him keep doing it again and again and again, unlike a jazz guy would do. And AJ takes a swing at Phil, and Keith, as Keith describes it, he like grabs his fist out of the air and said, AJ, you can get into a fight, but don't hit Phil in the teeth. He'll never play tuba again. So AJ turns and he smashes a clock.
Oh.
And Keith made them sign the clock, and I have the clock now. Oh, Keith gave me the clock.
Yeah, what time did it stop at?
I don't know, but I kept it at 4:20.
Okay.
Yeah, Keith, man. Keith was
I never had a conversation with him where I wasn't physically assaulted.
Oh, well.
Oh, wow. Really?
He would grab you or smack you in the arm or something. Out of love.
I had plenty, but...
Out of love. Oh, I mean, it was never... No, it wasn't. It wasn't bad. I'm not saying it was a bad thing.
Definitely wouldn't wanted to have gotten into a fist fight.
No. But he... He was really
He
the
tried to sit on me once.
Oh, I can believe
so
that.
Huge.
Yeah.
He tried to sit on me at the Circle Bar once.
But he was really the impetus.
I had a spike.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He was the impetus for the film because I heard those two stories that he had, and I said, oh, we've got a movie. And
then it
was at Glenn Hartman's Firstborn's Bris.
Okay.
Yeah. It was
a lot of characters.
Yeah, I got a lot of
characters in the story.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Well, let's accelerate this. A little bit.
So after that, I get it into my head that I need to make a fiction film. I make Angels Die Slowly, and that doesn't really do anything. So I have to kind of give up, and I go to grad school. I go to USC's Masters of Professional Writing program.
So you've done a whole lot of stuff. You've made a bunch of different films.
Yeah, I made two feature films, about 10 shorts. And then
all self-taught.
Yeah, I never went to film school.
Now, and then you enter them in like the new NO Film Festival and in the local stuff here
they
or New York.
Nothing. They didn't like me.
Yeah,
New Orleans like Film Festival didn't like me.
They didn't like our film either. They liked my shorts, but not our film.
They just liked
jockey shorts.
Yeah, they didn't.
Yeah,
I thought a feature film about the Rebirth Brass Band would have played the New Orleans Film Festival.
You would have thought.
But yeah. You know what? I
fuck them.
I had my screening at the Canal Place, and I made $1,500.
All right.
Oh, so fuck them. I do say fuck them.
So
fuck
you
the
got
New
that
Film
money.
Yeah, yeah, right. So then... So in grad school, I learned how to really write long fiction, and I write my first two novels, and then and I start teaching because, that's what you do.
Now your first novel. How did you get into the idea of writing a novel?
I always wanted to write a novel. Even from when I first started writing, I was like, I always want to at least have one novel, and I want to write my New Orleans novel. And so this novel is called Looking Back on Sodom, and it's the year before Katrina. So my mentor, Richard Rayner, who's a great novelist and screenwriter, he called it a Paradise Lost for New Orleans Bohemia.
Okay, now this was written pre-Katrina.
No, it was written after Katrina.
Okay.
Yeah, this was written in, I wrote it in 2012.
But it's about pre-Katrina.
Yeah, it's about 2005.
Okay.
And so I have a story, I have a bunch of stories. It's all Bywater and, musicians and artists and weirdos and all my stories. There's a interracial romance because I tend to do that all the time, even because I'm in one. And that one did sell to Black Rose Publishing out of Texas, but it did go out of print. So by the time this drops, I'm finally going to put it back up on Amazon, so at least it'll be available.
Nice.
Looking back on Sodom.
And it'll be a print on demand.
Yes, it will be print on demand.
Yeah, okay.
That's the way to go, man.
But then I shifted from there to genre fiction. So now I'm writing mostly fantasy, and that led me to making these two anthologies called Dirty Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And then
tell us about that.
Dirty Magic started as an anthology series where it was crime plus magic in a certain city.
Now, magic in what sense? Fantastical, supernatural.
Yeah, supernatural magic, magician, like wizards and warlocks and that sort of thing.
So going back to that L.A. writer who wrote about the river and stuff like that.
Yeah. So the first one took place in Los Angeles, and then the second one was New Orleans, and I got, and then I it was just too much work, and I couldn't keep up, and so I just kind of let it lie dormant. And then about 2 years ago, I said, I've always wanted to start a fantasy magazine.
Oh.
Because I love the genre. And I started Dirty Magic Magazine, and now we're in year two, and it's doing real well.
So it's porn?
No.
That's my fantasy.
No.
What kind of fantasy are you talking about?
Oh,
unicorns.
Wizards and shit. Yeah, wizards and shit. And then the other big thing I do is when at the start of COVID, my friend Lewis Daubin, who I went to Jesuit High with, he's the founder of the band Consortium of Genius, the COG, who are mad scientists trying to take over the world.
Oh.
And it's very Morgus, and we started a show because there were no gigs.
Right.
And so we said, okay, how can we help out the New Orleans, music scene during this time of no gigs? So we started a live streaming show. Now, most people would do what the place downtown did, and they would just turn a camera on and start hit live stream and then let the band play. Lewis is built differently.
Okay.
Lewis is, he was actually really good friends with Morgus, with Sid Noel.
Okay.
So, so we had to put on a show. So it became a game show where the mad scientist captures the band and they have to play for their lives.
Oh.
And you get donation, we rack up either donations to the lab or donations to the band.
Sort of a competition.
Yeah, it's a competition. And whoever gets the most money at the end of the show lives.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, you were one of the bands that died.
I went on with not the Iguanas. The Iguanas
it was Lynn,
that,
I think,
never
yeah.
appeared, but I went on with one of the bands I played in. For whatever reason, it wasn't the kind of fan base that would respond to something like that. Now, I noticed you have a lot of metery bands, a lot of heavy metal bands.
Yeah, that's Lewis. And, yeah, Lewis is very keyed into the metery metal scene.
Right, right.
And my influence is the Tin Man, the Klezmer All Stars. Happy Talk has just played recently. Malavitas.
Right. Malavitas, we're big fans of them.
Yeah. A few
Happy
other.
Happy Talk, big fans
of them.
Yeah, a few of the.
For every four Metairie metal bands, I get to sneak in an Orleans Parish band.
Right. So you guys took a hiatus for a while after COVID kind of subsided, but now you're back in production.
Yeah, we take about 3 months off at the beginning of the year. We're thinking about it, but it's every other Sunday night on escapefromthesecretlab.com, and it's fun. It's it's chaos.
Sure. It's nice to have. I played on this record in Switzerland one time, and on one of our nights off, they brought us to the town equipment depot, and about 40 guys showed up with different size cowbells, like these big giant cowbells
that have
a clapper in them, and you swing them on the side of you, and they walk in a circle, but really to practice walking across the field, which is a tradition on a Saint's Day that you march from your village to the village that has the patron saint's church in it. Anyway, it was an excuse for these guys to get together and drink beer and hang out with just the guys.
Right, right.
And it was cowbell practice.
Right.
So there's many sort of activities that men do or people do that I refer to as cowbell practice.
Oh, okay.
That would be one form of cowbell practice.
Well, yeah.
Like this is cowbell practice.
Yeah. We have a really good time, and I got to say, I was worried that we would get a lot of attitude from some musicians, and it never happened. Everybody who played it has been really cool. And, I mean, it takes place in Lewis's garage, out in Harahan. And it's also a working sound studio and a working...
Maybe because they're fucked up musicians.
Maybe.
High or drunk.
But, maybe.
Care.
But it's and I directed. It's an A camera, shoot, and I'm live switching.
So you
with no script
up on like monitor.
Yeah, I have it. Yeah, we have tripods.
You're just popping.
Yeah, Lewis, because Lewis is who he is. He built his own switcher, and it looks like a arcade game. It's got all arcade buttons. So child of the 80s, I love it because
definitely.
I'm all about arcades.
Yeah,
okay. That was a big, the fun arcade in Battery was my place.
Across from Dorgnax, me
right,
too.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's always been fun. So yeah, having that switcher has been like a normal person would have bought a switcher. Lewis made his own. That's kind of who Lewis is. We may do one more season. Not really sure, but
you're having fun.
Yeah, we're having fun, and right now we're in hell. The place is in hell, and I'm playing the landlord, the devil, who comes on and tortures Milo Pinkerton.
You're Mr. Roper.
I am.
Get some screen time.
Yeah, I finally got a little screen time.
Yeah,
so.
That's great.
So everybody can look for that on the Escape from Secret Lab YouTube channel.
Yep.
And they can find your Dirty Magic Magazine where?
DirtyMagicMagazine.com.
Okay, there you go. You have your fourth novel, which is titled what?
It's called Midnight Brew. It's a sequel to my vampire novel, Vamp City, which it takes place in Los Angeles. Midnight Brew is kind of a sequel. It's witches versus vampires with some voodoo zombies at the end. And on November 15th, we're having the book release party at Parlo Brewery in the Bywater.
Okay.
And
self-published?
This is self-published
Through Amazon.
Yeah, because the first novel was published by a small press, and he just doesn't. COVID kind of ruined him, because it was a sequel. I didn't think I could sell it anywhere,
right?
So I just decided to just go ahead and publish it. since that's what I do, I publish things now. Right. So,
well, we'll put the links to all that stuff in the show notes. Anybody that wants to see any of these things, I'll have the links.
Yeah,
for,
thank
for
you so much,
that.
And yeah, this has been a blast.
Yeah, man. Well, I hope it wound up being everything you'd hoped it would
yeah,
be.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was hoping to get interrupted more by Manny, but
you're all right.
Thank you.
All right. Watch you.
Well, thank you so much, Charlie. It's been a real pleasure having you on. And Manny, as always, what do we say?
Hey, listen, Charlie Brown, the trouble continues. No, the struggle continues.
We say trouble never ends.
Yes, exactly.
But
good
the
night.
Struggle continues.
Yeah, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
V-V-5-5-4-4-4. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
Everybody always picking on me.
That's him on his knees. I know that's him. Yelling 7-11 down in the boys' gym. Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown. He's a clown. That Charlie Brown. He's gonna get caught. Just you wait and see.
Why is everybody always picking on me?
Who's always writing on the wall?
Everybody always picking on me. Everybody always picking on me.